Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me for today's Newbies Workshop. I am being joined by Jen, one of your Sunlight mentors, and we're going to be talking all about literature-based learning and the non-history subjects. So we'll start with a little bit about literature-based learning, but then also jump into some of those subjects that seem a little harder to combine with literature. So let's start with some introductions. I am Sunny. I'm Sunlight's community manager and a Sunlight mom of two kids. Jen, you want to tell us a little bit more about you?
Hi, I'm Jen. I'm one of the mentors on the app, and you may also see me at conventions. If you are on the convention floor, I am a homeschool mom of four kids. I have used Sunlight for 21-ish years now, so ask me anything.
All right. Well, perfect. Thank you so much for being here. We also have Jonna in the chat, so you've probably seen her messages there as well. Make sure to tell us where you're joining from, how old your kids are, and feel free to ask questions throughout. Jen and I would love to customize this to what you guys want to hear. So we'll share our tips with you, but if you have specific questions, please let us know that as well. So Jen, let's talk about the literature-based learning. And of course, we don't drill kids with facts when we teach them through literature, but what is kind of a normal expectation for what your kids should know from this literature-based approach to teaching? You know, like, do they need to remember names and dates and specific things, or how do we assess that they're learning when we read to them?
Well, I'm not going to lie. Sometimes in the short term, assessing what they have gotten out of being read to can be a little twitchy. Sometimes I have read to my kids and then thought, were you even listening to me? Like, and then I listen to them play Legos, and all of a sudden it's King, what's his name, fighting against Syracuse in the, you know, and I'm like, okay, they were listening. Like, they actually ingested this. I don't know if your kids do that, Sunny, but sometimes because we're not drilling names and dates, you're like, is this getting in there? But I heard some, and I mean, years ago, I don't even remember where, somebody likened it to a spider web. Like, we're building strands and then we're hooking them together. And the more things you can hook together and the more connected we can make all of these little bits, that's when you really see them start to remember and make connections.
I love that. That's a great way of putting it. And I know when it comes to names, even when I read, I forget character names, I forget book titles. And it's when somebody says, oh, it's the book about XYZ, that I'm like, oh yeah, I read that. I love that. You know. And yes. So, yeah, and I notice it with my son. He never knows what the names of the characters are. I can say, what did so-and-so do? And that goes right over his head. But then if I'm like, what'd you get out of the story? Oh, well, the boy did this, and then his mom did this, and he can recount the story. So yeah, just kind of pay attention to cues like that. Like you said, kids playing. I love that with our little Sunlight kids. They always play what they're learning as well. And so yeah, you don't need to remember that this war started this year, as long as they can kind of figure out where in history that took place. Yep. Let's talk about the instructor's guide questions. I think they can be a huge help, but also there's times that they seem overwhelming, that there's so many questions, your kids aren't able to answer the questions. You know, what are some other ways to use them? Do you have to ask every single question? What are your options in using those instructor's guide questions?
I have never, not for one single book, gone through every question in the instructor's guide ever. It's too much for me, but I do like to use it as a guide for questions to ask to make sure that they're tracking. Right now we're reading, listening to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and the language in there is a little convoluted. It's a little, you know, long time ago British. And so it's hard to follow, but using the instructor's guide questions kind of focuses our attention so that I can be like, okay, so that was a different guy. And then they went to his house and they're trying to figure out why he won't come out. Oh, and so using the instructor's guide to kind of design my questions to make sure that we're tracking with a difficult story really helps. I also like it for the vocabulary, because sometimes the hang up is, I don't know what's going on because I don't know what that word is. And so when there's vocabulary or mapping, that also really focuses me on things that might be difficult to ask questions about so that I make sure we're on track.
Yeah, I love that. I know we get a lot of questions about, you know, how do you use the vocabulary piece? I know for us, I've never really gone over the words when we start reading, but it's one of those, like, if we come to a word and the child's like, what does that mean? Or if I'm like, what does that mean? You know, then we can go back and look at the instructor's guide and say, oh, this is what that is. Or if it's something I think my kids may not know, I'll say, well, do you know what that means? Or do you know where this takes place? A lot of times at the beginning of the books, it'll have the setting, you know, the time period, that type of information as well. But it's so funny because I have one child who loves the questions. That's just the way her brain works. And so I am more likely to ask her. But with my son, he does much better if I just say, what did you hear me read? And then he can describe the story. So yeah, kind of play around with that. What your kid likes to do, and it may be different depending on which child you're working with at the time. But yeah, don't feel like you have to do every single question or quiz kids on vocabulary or anything like that. You can take a much more laid back approach. Now, Jen, what about the child who struggles to pay attention or may even say, like, I don't want to listen to you read, this is boring, you know, I think especially with younger kids, they're inclined to do that. But even sometimes older kids, this book doesn't look interesting to me. You know, what approach do you take when it comes to that?
Well, for younger kids, you've heard me say this 1,000 times, exercise them. I know about my 48-year-old self. I can sit and pay attention longer when I have already worked out, taken a walk, gone hiking, gone for a swim, whatever. And I'm not like jittery with all my energy. Multiply that times 1,000 for the kid we're talking about. And if we go to the park first, exercise first, then they have a lot more attention span for being still. Alternately, let them sit in a rocking chair, hang upside down off the couch, sit on the trampoline, sit on the balance ball, whatever, so that they can use their bodies while they listen. I have one kid who I tried to be like, you have to sit still. And I watched him try to sit still and he's gripping the chair and his shoulders are tense. And he was concentrating so hard on sitting still, he wasn't hearing me. Where if I let him wiggle, which looked like not the way to do it, but when I let him wiggle or play Legos or play with clay or something, he listened and remembered the whole thing. So with those little ones who don't want to listen, if we wear them out a little, sometimes that helps.
Yeah.
The other ones, this is boring, I don't want to. I don't see anything wrong with letting them pick which. So like, these are the next three books we have to read. Which one would you like to start today? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, people need an element of control over their lives. And sometimes with teenagers, insisting that we can control every single thing has the opposite effect. So if you can give them an option, go for it.
Yeah, I think that's huge. Anytime a child has buy-in into what you're doing, they're instantly more engaged. I know I do this even when my kids are young. I stack all the books we're going to do today on the table. And I say, okay, what do you want to do first? Mm-hmm. And so I start that even when they're young. And also don't expect kids instantly to be into it either. I think my firstborn was kind of more the kid that would cuddle and sit there and listen. So I just assumed, oh, kids love stories. And then my second came along and he's much more active. He's super creative. So he's always got a game going in his head. So I have to make sure that I am the priority to what his focus is on before we start reading. And it took longer to kind of get him used to, okay, now we're going to listen to the story. Mm-hmm. You know, you can act it out while we do it. Like you said, exercise balls or standing or anything like that are great tips. But yeah, just don't automatically assume that, you know, your 4 or 5 year old is ready to sit and listen to more than maybe half a page. But they will eventually get it. Now that my kids are older, they both do great with that. So just a little encouragement on that. Now let's talk about how the learning happens with a literature-based approach. Things like context and making those historical events come alive or emotional connections, you know, because I think, Jen, sometimes it is hard to see early on because you're not testing these kids, you know, what are they learning? How do they understand how, you know, maybe this historical fiction fits into the broad scheme of history, those types of things. What do you think?
I think that the glory part of learning history or science or literature or whatever through stories is that we become emotionally involved. We fall in love with characters like Wilbur and Charlotte and Anne and Laura and all of those guys, and they become like people that we're involved with. And so all of the things, the historical events that happen, all of the years and the places and the names and the dates, get hooked onto those web strands of emotional connection. And those are the things we remember. And so, you know, like I could tell you all about the Transcontinental Railroad, but when you read about it in a story about a girl who you're already involved with, you remember all the details of, you know, grading and building and all of the things that, like, if I was just like, so today we're going to talk about how to grade a railroad, you'd be like, yawn, bye, no. But when we hook it into stories about kids who we can get emotionally involved with, like, we remember all of it.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I love it, especially when it comes to like military history, because I think a lot of times that's what we learn, right? This war happened here. This was the impact. This was the date. But when you can hear the perspectives of people going through those events, it makes them feel like, oh, that wasn't thousands of years ago. That's people like we live today, right? And so to me, I think that's super helpful. Also the emotional connection. If you've done Sunlight for any period of time, you know that a lot of the books are tearjerkers, and you get really involved and invested in those characters. And like you said, you learn details that you may not care about if you didn't know about this person who was doing this thing. But once you get into those characters, you do. Yeah. Another thing that I love talking to young Sunlight kids because they sound so smart. Their vocabulary is huge. They use grammar correctly. Yep. You know, how does reading to kids really benefit them in that regard?
So reading good literature to little kids is the highest grade of being a good example. You are reading to them excellent sentence structure, using proper grammar, using those great vocabulary words that are more than just easy reader words. And so they learn to speak like that. They learn the cadence of a good sentence. They learn what all those words mean, and then they use them in conversation with their grandmother, which makes you look really good.
Yeah, that's so true. And I always tell people when they're starting out and they're like, is this working? How's it going? Give it a year or two and you will start to see it because your kids, I mean, their vocabularies and everything take off.
Oh, yeah.
Also, I think something that's really fun about teaching this way is that kids develop that love of learning for learning's sake. And it's not like, oh, we're doing school. This is boring. I don't want to do it. And so I love seeing kids, you know, especially any homeschool kid, but especially after Sunlight, when you take them to a museum or a historical site or something like that, because they do, it comes alive and they get really invested in it.
Yes.
But let's talk a little bit about those practical tips. I know we already talked about letting kids wiggle and getting exercise in the morning. What are some other opportunities, maybe for time of day or location or things like that, where you can shift some of that reading so that it doesn't feel like they're just sitting all day long listening to you read to them? How do you break up that schedule?
I mean, one of my favorite tips is save something back for bedtime, especially one of those stories that we're emotionally involved with. If you can save the read aloud back for bedtime, then not only could maybe somebody else do it, if dad or grandma or Aunt Sue or whoever wants to be involved, hand them a book, give them some kids, like this is what we do. But it does break up the day, where if we can do, you know, math and history and a science experiment and some language arts, and then at the end of the day, we can kind of cuddle up on the couch and everybody can just get in relax mode, then not only do you sometimes get extra pages in because nobody wants you to stop reading, but everybody's just so much more calm and focused. And I'm not looking at the clock thinking, what time do we have to leave if I'm going to stop at Target and get my pickup before soccer practice? And so it just has a whole different calm feel if we save it till bedtime. I've also done a ton and a half of school in the car. Like, one kid has soccer practice, so I make sure their stuff is all done, and I pack up little sister and her bag of tricks, and off we go, and school in the parking lot, knowing that the playground is right there. And if we get this reading done and mama's happy, you can play on the playground for the whole rest of soccer practice. I found that to be very motivating for several of my children.
Yes, I'm actually doing that tonight. I have one child going to dance class, so I'm going to be teaching the other kid in the car while she's in there. So yeah, I love to do that as well. Another time too, if you have a child that wants to chatter and they have a hard time keeping their mouth still, feed them while you read to them, because then their mouth is engaged on chewing. They cannot talk. They cannot distract their siblings. I have one kid like that that never wanted to stop talking. And it would be like, hold on, let me read this chapter. Then we can talk all you want to when we're done. And I found that by feeding the kids while I was reading to them, that was also a great way to keep them quiet, to keep them in one place. We mentioned doing school in the car. We haven't talked about audiobooks yet. That's another great, if you spend a lot of your time driving around to various places, get some of those read alouds or even some of the readers on audiobook and then play them in the car. And then that way, whoever's in there can learn them. There's no problem with, you know, older kids listening in or younger kids listening in to somebody else's stuff either. So just some tips there for getting all of those things done. But let's talk about the non-history subjects now. Maybe the things that are a little harder to figure out how to fit in. I know read alouds are fun. You know, even the history and Bible that's read out loud can be fun. But what about math? That's kind of the scary homeschool subject, I think, for a lot of people. So when it comes to math, how do you decide what you do and how do you fit that in with the other subjects?
I got very lucky in my homeschool career. I discovered Matthew C very early on, and it made sense to me, which I thought was a hot miracle. I was not a very mathy person. I can say now I'm on my 9th round of algebra, and it gets way easier after like 7-8 rounds. So, you know, for me, math was just, this is what we're doing. This is the way we've always done it. This, and it's worked. Matthew C has worked for all my kids. Hallelujah. I never worried so much about fitting it in, like making it mesh with everything else. Although I'll tell you what, like, we're reading about Descartes and learning about Descartes in math and reading about Descartes in history right now. And that was not planned. It just sometimes fits. But we tend to get math done early, especially for my kids who are not as enthusiastic about daily math practice as others. We get it done so that it's at least done, you know, because it's only a certain amount of work. It's not like this needs to take all day. And so if we can kind of knock that out, then anything else we have to take with us on our journey to soccer practice or dance class or wherever, is the easy stuff, is just the reading or just worksheets or just whatever. And they know their math is done. And sometimes that creates a level of peace that you don't have when you take your math book with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, Jen, you said that you discovered Matthew C early. I've actually used two different math programs. So I started my kids with Horizons in kindergarten, and then Horizons only goes up through sixth grade. So we switched to Matthew C for pre-algebra when my daughter hit that age. And I will give it another plug. The video instruction is outstanding if you have forgotten how to do stuff. I was pretty mathy in school, but in my career, I've never used beyond probably sixth grade math. And so I had to relearn, you know, pre-algebra and then algebra, yes. All of that. But Matthew C does have that video instruction. I think Saxon does too. There's a few others. Sunlight carries like 6 different programs. So Hopefully you can find one that is a good fit. But yeah, don't feel like you have to get stuck with one if your kids aren't learning it. And Sunlight does provide schedules for that, but a lot of times people don't know where to find them. So Jen, should they follow our schedules? Where can they find them? And do they have to follow our schedule?
You do not have to follow any schedule. You can just go as fast or as slow as you need to. The homeschool police will not come after you if you do not finish one math book per public school calendar year. No problem. If you would like the sunlight schedule for whatever math you've purchased. It's on the website, sunlight.com, in your account. You click on your name, not if I'm getting this right. You click on your name, and in your account, one of the choices is your downloads. And if you go into your downloads, you should see your available math schedules in there, right?
Yes. So it'll match with the math program that you have, or like if you're doing a different handwriting than what's scheduled in your Sunlight Instructor's Guide, any of those supplements, you do have a schedule there. I did not discover that early when I first started sunlighting. And so we just do one lesson a day, and that's worked for us. And so we still now, I don't even know what my math schedule, what I should be on for either of my kids. We just do one lesson a day. So I do think math is something important to do a little bit every day, because you do have to build on concepts. It's not like other subjects where you can kind of jump around. So I would not suggest skipping math, but you definitely don't have to do it on our schedule. What about if your child is struggling to understand maybe the video instruction and the way you're teaching it? I mean, what do you do in that case? I know sometimes my daughter especially has said, I don't get the way you're explaining it. So what are some ideas if people are struggling there and their child's just not quite grasping it the way they're teaching it? What have you done?
I back up. So like I can speak to Matthew C. I've used Saxon for different things, but it's a math book. They're all built the same way to a degree. If there's something that is not sinking in this lesson, we back up. Did you get the lesson before? Did you really master it? Can you explain it to me? How about the lesson before that? Because I find that the two or three lessons before this one are what we need to have mastered and then maybe integrate into what we're doing now. And so I have spent a lot of time in teaching my kids math going, you know how to do this. Remember when we learned, oh yeah, okay, this is where you use it. Mm-hmm. Now you have to do that thing and then do that other thing. And if you combine them on the right kind of problems, then you can get the answer. And so I back up a little. Is this working? And if the kid doesn't like how I'm explaining it to them, I have them explain it to me. How does this work? What did he just say? What are the three steps to get from the problem they gave you to the answer? Like, what are we trying to do? My kids roll their eyes and say, get X by itself. Because that's how many times I have said, so what we're trying to do is get X by itself. So what can you do to make that happen? You know, having the child explain it, because where they get stuck is where they're stuck. So then you know where they're stuck, and then you can address that specific thing.
Well, and you brought up the point too, that sometimes they might have understood the concept in this lesson, but they haven't made the connection that that's what they're using here. Yeah. We see that happen a lot where it's like, oh, you know how to do this. You just don't realize that's what you're supposed to do here. Another thing that we like to do is if you're not getting it when I explain it to you, your dad's going to explain it to you now. My husband's super mouthy and kind of is nerdy about it and dives into these deep explanations. And so a lot of times my daughter will figure it out all of a sudden when she realizes that she has to go listen to dad's math lecture. So that might be another option too, is like, oh, well, you can go learn it over here. And then, yeah, all of a sudden she's highly motivated. Another thing we'll do is we'll watch the video again together. I don't always watch every single video with her the first time. So, you know, we might watch it together. That way I know how she's being taught, you know, in Matthew C versus how I might be thinking it in my head, which could be different than the way she's being taught. Because sometimes things like terminology and stuff like that will trip kids up when it's brand new. So also we love Mathtacular in our house. That's a supplement that Sunlight sells, and they're just fun videos that make math applicable in real life. And so that's great for reinforcing concepts in elementary, you know, early middle school ages as well. But let's talk about science. Science is something that Sunlight carries. We've redone kindergarten through level D in recent years, and we're currently working on updating other levels as well. So I think the new science is so fun. But I feel like science is the subject that people a lot of times feel like they can't get to, or maybe they have a hard time completing experiments. So do you feel that science has to be done daily like it's scheduled in the IG, or how do you make time for science if that's not the area you gravitate towards.
I don't think it needs to be done daily the way that I think math needs to be done daily, because math is a skill-based subject that you just have to have that continuous practice at. My oldest, her opinion about sunlight science was that if we're going to pull out all these books, can I just do the whole thing? Can I just do the whole week, Mom? Can I? So she tended to do science 1 or 2 days a week, which left us time on a day where we didn't have any other science to do the experiment. As she got older, we tended to kind of block schedule it even more, where she would do kind of a whole unit or several weeks, and then we would do a couple of the experiments all together. Like, while we're making a mess, can we just do the whole thing? Because, I mean, by that time I had like another toddler, and, you know, it was just like, oh my gosh, if we're going to make a mess, can we really get a lot of value out of this? So we felt free to block schedule science through the years. Have you done that?
Yeah, I really have. It's funny because I actually majored in science. I love science, but I've never been a fan of labs and experiments. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of with you where if we're going to make a mess this one time, let's do it all and go all out. My older child does a lot of her experiments on her own, but my son still needs us to help him. But that's something that we oftentimes will do on the weekend too, when we have more time and it's not like, oh, you're going to destroy the kitchen and then, you know, I'm going to have to make dinner and there's going to be stuff in the way. So a lot of times that's a Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon activity in our house. That's also something that I will outsource to my husband. He loves the experiments way more than I do. And so the boys will go have experiment afternoon together. And then I can just do the reading, which is really my favorite part. But yeah, we definitely block it. If we're reading, you know, one book for 2 or 3 days, and that's what we're answering the activity sheet questions on, we will, you know, okay, well, today we're going to do science. So let's do all the activity questions for the week. Also, if I know the activity questions start young, like kindergarten, if your child is not writing yet, write for them. That is totally fine. And I think sometimes that tricks people or trips them up a little bit, where they're like, oh my goodness, they have to fill in answers. No, if your child's not at that level, fill that out for them, you know, ask the questions orally. We do that a lot too. But that's kind of always been my approach to science, so that, yeah, it's important and it's something fun to learn about, but I don't like messes and I don't like hands-on. That's not the way I learn. But if you have a kid who learns that way, make sure that you're somehow making time for that. So my youngest, he's very creative and kinesthetic, and so I feel it's very beneficial for him to do them. But if dad wants to do science experiments and you don't like them, feel free to pass that off. Or also another thing about science too, that we didn't talk about, is that even if you're not combining kids in other subjects, oftentimes you can with science. Experiments are fun, you know, for a wider age range. So I know I've done that with the kids too, where they'll do their experiments together, even though they're 5 years apart, they've never been combined in anything else, but a science concept, you know, it's more subject based. Yep. So you don't have to do it in a certain order. We have a question from Linda saying, my second grader is having a hard time memorizing math facts. He's a hyperactive kid, and so we've tried jumps and claps and other activities, but it's just not clicking. What do you recommend?
How old is he?
He's second grade.
So my math solution for everything through and including algebra is M&Ms. So if your kid has some other candy drug of choice, but M&Ms worked in my house, because I could say, if I have 6 puppies and I break them up into 2 equal sets, how many puppies sit in each hula hoop? And the kid is like, what? And if I say, I have 6 M&Ms and you want to make sure that your sister does not get more than you, how many M&Ms do you each get? He's like, 3. So somehow applying it to their personal life, not just with dolphins and puppies, but like their actual personal life, did wonders for my kids. And my go-to was M&Ms. So when I taught them like all those, you know, so if you have 5 M&Ms and I give you 2 more, how many do you have? 7, right? you know the math facts. We just need to engage the part of your brain, like we were saying with reading stories, that emotional part of your brain that needs, that feels like it's important to apply this information to a real life scenario. And that really cemented the math facts for my kids.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, what you said about, you know, when it matters to you, right? They might be doing the manipulative blocks or something from their math program, and those are just blocks. But like you said, when it comes to something you're going to get that your sibling's not, or it's candy or something like that, all of a sudden you realize it. And I will say, Linda, second grade, I mean, that's still pretty young. My son's in third grade, and I still catch him when he's trying to multiply, kind of sitting there, and he's actually adding, and, you know, and he'll be like adding it up. So I wouldn't worry too much at this age, but Jen, like you said, like, make it applicable, make it fun. Also, Lisa and Jonna did a live, I want to say it was about a month and a half ago, about some different math games you can play with your kids, whether that be playing cards or sidewalk chalk and jumping to different numbers. Like, you might write the answers out on the sidewalk, and then you throw a math problem at them and have them race, you know, to the answer. So I would definitely say go back and check out that video as well, because there's a lot of fun, more game ideas and less, okay, now we're going to practice math. I know Lisa says flashcards she doesn't love. I know they were never a success with my kids either, because that feels like school. But M&Ms, you know, games, that doesn't feel like school. Then you're just playing. So yeah, it looks like Jonna put in some card games in there as well. So yeah, hopefully that helps you out on the math packs. Let's jump to language arts now. This is another area that, you know, people get into it and they're like, oh, there's too much work, or I don't know how to teach this, or all of that. Do you think that language arts, we've talked about science doesn't have to be daily, math probably should. What about language arts? Should that be done daily, or is there anything you can kind of block schedule there as well?
I think reading should be done daily. Like, we're going to read every single day. I'm going to read to you every single day. You're going to read every single day, no matter what. The work part of language arts, copy work or creative writing or you know, grammar or anything like that. Here's my cat. Sorry.
That was a microphone.
Every time. I feel like that should be done several days a week. Like, I feel okay leaving science experiments to do several at once in a while. I wouldn't do that with language arts, but I don't feel as strongly about it as I do about, like, we must practice math every day. Mm-hmm. That's a wishy-washy answer, but, you know, I think that some kind of writing work is probably a really good thing to do every day.
Yeah, I agree with what you were saying about the reading, especially when a child's learning to read. I know my son especially would forget what he did, you know, 2 or 3 days ago. But if we did it every day, he did a better job of, oh, yeah, A sounds like this, B sounds like this. Otherwise, he would get a little confused. So I think especially in that learning to read stage, something every single day, even if it's not the full IG assignment. I know we have definitely slowed down or sped up, but yeah, definitely agree on that. And same thing with writing. For my kids, when they're little, it's the handwriting, right? They do some amount of handwriting every day just to kind of reinforce what they're learning. And that way it doesn't feel like, oh, I forgot this. It's been a week since I last read or wrote anything down. But I do agree on, like, the creative expression, the maybe mechanics practice. You can kind of double some of that up a little bit. Also, we like to do those assignments orally in the younger grades. That's another thing, like those science questions, that, you know, if your child may have these amazing creative ideas and be able to do an assignment orally, but they don't have the, you know, writing skills yet to actually write down what they're saying. So I love, let your child get as creative as they want. You scribe for them, write down what they're saying. You know, if it's something short, then, you know, have them copy it maybe. But I mean, my son's in third grade and I still scribe a lot of stuff for him, because if he has to slow down and remember, oh, I need a capital letter, or how do I spell this word, or oh, I need a period, he's going to forget the thought process of where his story is going. And so that's something I think, yeah, if your child cannot write yet, you know, or not as well as they can create, you know, describe for them. But we see this question come up time and time again, what to do if your reading writing levels are not the same. So a lot of times kids learn to read faster and better than they can write. So do you put them in the more advanced reading program, language arts? Do you mix and match? What are their options if those levels are not the same?
Well, first, let me say, I think those levels are hardly ever the same. Hardly ever. We learn to read much, much earlier than we learn to write as well as the things we can read. I mean, I'm an adult. I can read Shakespeare, but with a gun to my head, I couldn't write in iambic pentameter and have it make any sense. Like, my reading and writing levels don't match. Mm-hmm. We always recommend language arts that goes with their writing level because they're going to have to perform the writing. And so what I always did, because all of my kids, all four of them, they had this issue. They could read much harder things than the books that go along with the language arts that is at their writing level. So we did those books knowing they would be easy. The writing is easy to copy for them because they can read much harder things. Their books are easy to get through because, of course, they could read much longer things. And then on the side, I fed them other books. Mm-hmm. At their level to challenge them or meet them where they are or whatever, knowing that we're using these books that are too easy, still good quality books, to show good writing at their writing level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I know some people do kind of mix and match. I've always used the same reader level with the same language arts because a lot of times passages from those books are used in the language arts examples. And yeah, I absolutely agree. If the reading part is too easy, that's great. That's a confidence booster for your kids because they're like, oh, look how fast I can read this book. You know, school's easy for me. But then you make sure that they're not being stretched so far on the written work that it becomes super stressful and challenging. Now, we do sometimes hear, though, that assignments are taking forever when it comes to like creative expression, or maybe they're not quite ready for dictations yet. So what do you feel you have to do? And then what can you skip or should you skip? How do you decide that depending on, you know, the capabilities of your child and what level you're doing?
My goal is always to do about 75% of the creative expression in any given year. And so we skip anything that is super painful. Anything that comes in a week where I have other priorities. Like right now, my son is doing theater and opening night is on Friday. And I guarantee you, we will not get to any kind of creative expression this week. It's just not going to happen. We might do that assignment later. We might do that assignment instead of something else later. Or we might just go back to it when this show is over. You know, so my goals were always to get most of it in. But sometimes it just, an assignment just doesn't really mesh with a kid. And so sometimes I can switch it up. You don't want to write about that person. Let's write about this other person. You don't want to write about a squirrel. Well, would you rather write about a skunk? Great. I don't care what you write about. Just do the thing. You know, if you have some great idea, like write about your great idea there. It makes no difference to me. And again, it's an instructor's guide. So if you veer off course a little bit, it's okay. But yeah, we try to do most of it. And some, like Thanksgiving week, I can guarantee you there will be school things that I'm like, you know what, this is enough. Let's go make the sweet potatoes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know for us, we always try to do at least a rough draft of each assignment. Like what you said, though, if the topic is not what they want to write about, you know, but it's a persuasive essay, okay, well, don't tell me how you want a pet cat, you know, tell me about how you want an allowance or, you know, whatever, you know, topic speaks to them at that time. And so we will kind of change the topics like that. Also, you know, we try to do the rough draft. I always read out what the IG rubric says, like what we're grading on, and they'll do that. And then sometimes I just will go through and, oh, you misspelled this, or, oh, the grammar was wrong here, but we don't revise and redo that assignment. I know I've got one from 3 weeks ago that my daughter was supposed to do a newspaper and she typed up all of her articles, but we haven't gotten around to formatting into a newspaper. So at this point I'm like, okay, well, you know, your content is good. Everything you wrote is good. That's the hard part, you know, finding the time to format it into an actual newspaper. Probably don't need to do because technology changes all the time. And, you know, it'll be different when you're an adult anyway. It's more the writing style that you're working on there. And another thing that we get a lot, though, is like, especially as the kids get older, if you are not a strong writer or speller or grammar is kind of a weak area for you as the parent, how do you accurately, you know, guide your kids and assess their writing to make sure that they're going to develop into strong enough writers?
Well, I think that the rubrics that Sunlight puts in their language arts are magical. Mm-hmm. I think those are the best thing since sliced bread. And, I have heard so many parents say, I'm not a strong writer. How do I know what this is supposed to look like? But then you have a 5 or 6 point little box that says, did they do this? Did they do this? Did they do this? And the wonderful part about a rubric, I mean, I'm an English teacher by trade, so I'm all about a good rubric. The great part about a rubric, though, is that it doesn't just tell you whether it's right or wrong. It's built in that you give them specific feedback if it's wrong. Mm-hmm. To say, you know, are all the right words capitalized? Then you can say to your child, there are some words in here that are capitalized that maybe shouldn't be. Can you find 3 of them? Mm-hmm. And then we have not just you stink at this, which nobody wants to hear, but a specific thing that they can go back and improve. And then next time you can say, and remember about, you know, not capitalizing words that don't need to be capitalized. And, you know, even if you're not an English teacher or a magnificent writer, it shows you what to find. And they can be pretty repetitive. So over the course of time, I mean, just like in every other subject of Sunlight, the mom learns just as much as the kid, right? Amen? Is it just me?
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. The rubrics. And then also on the dictation, or not the dictation, the mechanics practice, it'll tell you, like, this week we're going over adjectives, this week, you know, capital letters, whatever it may be. And like you said, they build, so they get progressively harder as the child gets older. But that has been great because, yeah, if you're looking at a kindergartner trying to figure out how to teach them to write is an overwhelming idea. But when it's, oh, today we're just going to talk about what a declarative sentence is, you know, it makes it much easier to come along that way. And I love the rubrics. Like I said, I show them to my kids before they even do the assignment. So they know, here's what I'm looking for. If you don't include this, we're going to take off points on that. And I do generally grade them based on the points in the rubric. And it's not like a harsh grade, but it's more like, this is A level work. Oh, this time I feel like you slept off. You knew how to write better, but you wrote more C level work to kind of keep them motivated and, you know, keep your expectations where you want them to be. Because especially older kids will get lazier and you sometimes have to remind them, okay, that's not your best work. I know you can do better than that. So that's how I approach language arts. Let's talk about electives. Any class that's not really assigned, Sunlight does carry their own electives, but we don't have like that as part of your science, language arts, or HBL. So when do they become important? Do you even have to do them? And if so, how do you decide what you're going to do?
I mean, you don't have to do them. And you don't, I mean, you don't have to do anything. All of those elective things are elective. They're extra. They are optional. In my experience, my kids came to me and said, why are we not doing art? Why am I not learning a language, mom? You know, can't I do Latin, Spanish, whatever? And so I kind of followed their lead. So of course I have one who's an artist and then nobody else could care less about art. So, you know, just when you think you have a good thing going, the next one throws you a curveball. You know, and so I decided that in middle school, my kids would learn at least a little bit of Latin, not because I need them to speak Latin to their grandparents, but because, well, really two reasons. Number one is that if you've studied any Latin at all, any other language that comes from Latin, Spanish, French, whatever, is so easy to learn. And the other thing is the vocabulary. If you've learned any Latin at all of a sudden, there are a lot of English words that make good sense all of a sudden. And so we do a little Latin. So I throw that in. But like, you know, we a lot of times follow the lead of the kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. Because I know I always thought of foreign language as like a high school subject, right? Because that's when I took foreign language, was in high school. Before that, in school, we didn't do that. But then when I had a child who was like, I want to learn Spanish, you know, why aren't we doing this yet? I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess we can do this now. We don't have to wait. Or like typing, right? That was big in, I think, seventh grade when I was in school. And a lot of times we have to kind of break this mindset of, oh, well, this is when I learned this. You know, when your kids are ready to learn it, go ahead and teach it to them if you want. What about though in the area, you mentioned art, and I am definitely not an artsy person at all, but it's so funny because my mom is super creative. I grew up doing all the crafts, and as an adult, I was like, never again, go to Nana, and she will do all that fun stuff with you. What are some ideas if your child comes to you and they do want to take an elective class, but that is not your strength or anything you have any desire to teach? What are some ideas for those types of situation?
So my solution to that was to hire it out. Mm-hmm. My oldest had a private art teacher from the time she was six till the time she graduated from high school. And I was like, can I write you a check? Because I don't really art. And she was blessed with some of the most amazing people who taught her what they knew. So she learned a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And it was a fantastic experience all the way around. Like I said, the rest of my kids could not have cared any less about art at all. They got that from me. I'm like, I'm the mom of an artist. I don't do that. But, you know, I mean, one of the places we started with a lot of the elective things was just going through the Sunlight elective section and being like, what looks good? Like, what are you thinking of? You know, do you want to do this? Do you want to do this? Do you want to do this? And they picked some things that I never would have thought they would pick. But, you know, there you go.
Yeah. I think let them provide the lead there. And then, yeah, I'm with you. If I am not interested in the subject or don't like it, I will gladly send you elsewhere and you can do that. You can meet friends who want to do that activity with you. You mentioned your child in theater. I also have theatrical kids. And so they go and do theater with other kids. That's a hard one to do by yourself. And so it's a great, great way to get them, you know, around other kids. You can do this in a co-op or even just the regular lessons and classes that kids in school take. I know my daughter has danced for years, and so that was something that we just signed her up at the local dance studio. Also, if you're homeschooling your kids, you are spending a lot of time with them. So it's kind of nice to outsource a few things like that. So that gives you a little time apart since you're not getting that like you would if they were in school all day. So that's how we handle that stuff. Let's talk a little bit about transitioning to independent work, though, as your kids get older. And this is always a big question, you know, when is my child ready? Or, oh, I just had a baby and I need to get my oldest more independent. You know, how do you figure out how to do that and when to do that?
Well, it's like anything else. The way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time. And when to do it, usually, you know, coincides with the new baby or the move or the new job or whatever makes it necessary. So, but it will take a long time. So I started out being like, okay, here's what we're doing for math. There are three problems left on this page. I'm going to the bathroom. When I come back, I want one of those to be done. Or I'm right here. We can talk about it. I can answer questions, but I'm going to get up from this chair and unload the dishwasher. You can finish this page while I'm standing right here, but doing something else. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, we literally started with 30 seconds at a time, one problem at a time, knowing that they had to be independent. And of course, by the time, you know, my youngest was homeschooling, I had one in high school and one in middle school. And so like they had to be independent. Mm-hmm. And so we just started very, very small. Not even like, I'm going to take a shower, finish this page. Like, I'm going to walk out of this room for 30 seconds. Just do one problem while I'm gone. And then you build it up from there. I found that food rewards worked really well. Like, if I come back and this is done, again with the M&Ms, if I come back and this is done, that would be amazing. Here's a treat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. Not forever, every time, but like just to get them in the mood, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you have a kid that's easily distracted. I love what you said about, I'm going to be right here unloading the dishwasher, you know, depending on the personality of your kid. Cause again, I have one that is very independent, self-motivated. Mm-hmm. Honestly, as my firstborn, I thought, oh, this is easy. I've got this. And then, you know, your second child comes along and it's very humbling and he's the creative one. He gets distracted easily. And so, yeah, don't necessarily walk away and leave that child to their own devices, mm-hmm. even for 30 seconds or a minute, but starting one thing at a time. And like you said, just kind of stepping away, you know, and if you need me, I'm here, especially for like math or something like that. But I always start it with handwriting because you get such a little chunk of handwriting, yep. you know, that it's like, okay, here's how you form this letter. Now I want you to write this by yourself. And then moving to math, and I gradually add on one subject at a time. I think it's unrealistic to take a child who's been doing everything with you and then, oh, now they can read. So here, do several things at once. But feel free to do it throughout the year. I know my daughter, once she could read, did not want to read her readers aloud anymore. She wanted to start reading those to herself, and then she would tell me about them afterwards.
Well, in my step, the intermediate step with independent reading was mm-hmm. that you didn't have to read it out loud to me, but you did have to read it where I could watch you doing nothing but sitting there reading it.
Yeah.
Because I have one who doesn't like to answer questions. Don't ask me what it was about. I read it. I'm not going to talk about it. Okay. But then the flip side of that is that if you want me to know that you sat and read for 45 minutes, I need to see you do that if you're not going to discuss it with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's like, if you don't want to read it out loud, fine. You can, if you don't want to read it out loud to me, maybe you can read it out loud to little brother, read it out loud to the cat, or just sit and read it to yourself, but where I can see you. And then once you're like, of course she's reading, what else would she be doing? Then, you know, take it to your room, report back, whatever is fine. Some kids that happens instantaneously. Mm-hmm. Some of them it takes forever.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point too. Yeah. Is don't assume that what one child did really well, the other one will do really well as well.
That second one.
I was just going to say, my son still has to read out loud because I don't trust him not to.
Exactly. But it's funny, my kid, my second born, fantastic son, who was exactly that child, now reads aloud daily to his wife.
Oh, I love that.
That's part of what they do. So, I mean, it all comes out good in the end. It's just in the meantime, when you're like,
yeah, and I think what you said about the elephant, one bite at a time, one day at a time, you know, consistency, you know, and remember you're training them for future things, future independence. And yeah, for some kids it is very quick and they can do everything by themselves on their own, and that's the way they like to do it. But for other kids it is going to take longer. They may want to do it on their own, and like I said with my son, I don't trust him not to skip pages at this point just to get it done. And so he does still have to read out loud, but once he proves that he's going to read the whole thing, then we'll move him towards that independent path as well. But I think the nice thing about, you know, doing sunlight and reading to your kids is they do develop that love for learning. And, you know, it's kind of contagious. As they get older, it gets easier. So those of you that have a bunch of littles right now, don't worry. it will work out. In a few years, you'll be looking back and saying, oh yeah, now it's so much easier. And, you know, I remember being stressed all the time when they were younger, or whatever. But I know now, you know, I'm able to talk to you, Jen, while my kids are working out there. And, you know, it's not what it would have been a few years ago. So
mine is actually, my youngest is at theater. So there are actually zero children.
Oh, wow.
Right now, which this theater show has been the first time in 25 years that I've had this experience on a regular basis. And so I sit and just kind of like, I don't know quite what to do with myself.
What to do with yourself.
There's nobody to listen for. It's, yeah. So.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. So do you have any other last minute tips? We have about 5 minutes left before we have to go. So do you have anything else that you would share or encouragement or ideas for people that are new right now?
My encouragement about literature-based learning is that it's not instantaneous. You are not going to see immediate results and memorization of anything on day one or day 30. But if you trust the process, you will see results. You will see kids making connections between things in separate books. You will see kids making connections between the historical timeline and characters that they know and love. You will see that. It will happen because that's the way it works. I would also encourage you that, like, the educational researchers who study things like SAT scores and college entrance and all of those very important goals that, you know, we've all had in the back of our heads all these years, they consistently say kids who are most prepared, most able, most high scoring, what do they have in common? They were read to. Mm-hmm. These are the children who were read to. So if in a day you're like, I'm pulling my hair out, everything has gone wrong, all we did was read, you're doing okay. Because mm-hmm. in the end, that's one of the things that affects their future success the most. So when you say all we did is read, you check that off like it's a really, really important box.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. You brought up the timeline too, which we haven't talked about. A lot of people are like, oh, do I have to do the timeline? I highly, highly suggest it, because after you've done a few years of Sunlight, it's super helpful to be like, oh, this was happening in this country at the same time this was happening in this country. Yes. I know for me growing up, I never quite made those connections in school, because it might be like, oh, in 1640, this happened. And then over here in 1640, this happened. But I never quite got it, right? That it was all happening at the same time. Yeah. And a lot of times, you know, it was like, here's ancient history, then here's European history. Now America's a country and we're not going to learn about what's happening anywhere else in the world for the rest of your education. And I know that once I started doing Sunlight with my kids, I was like, oh my goodness, the same time this was happening in the US, this yeah. was happening in this country. Exactly. And so I love that about Sunlight. You know, we both mentioned that we have learned a ton. And so using that timeline has been such a helpful tool yeah. in our house to really make those connections and those things that, you know, we're lacking, I think, in my own, you know, American education in the 90s.
You can learn all the facts and all the dates, but if mm-hmm. nothing ever makes you stop and go, oh, that happened right at, no, because that had to happen first. Oh my gosh, Mom. Like, if you never have that moment, what have you really learned?
Exactly.
So,
yeah, so true. So, yeah, just to encourage all of you that are new, if you're wondering if it's working or how to corral everybody or whatever, we will tell you yes. Like you said, Jen, future success, a huge indicator of that is how often children are read to. So, you are on the right track. And if you ever have questions or need help with your specific situation, get in the app and let us know. You are surrounded in there by our Sunlight mentors, as well as other experienced Sunlighters who have walked the path before you and can give you some ideas and some suggestions, you know, and a lot of us have our favorite programs or books. So we will definitely get excited with you when you have those successes or when your kids really connect with a certain character. So make sure you're there in the app and letting us know if you need anything. Jen, thank you so much for being here today and talking with me. And Jonna, thank you for running chat. If you guys need anything at all, let us know.